The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Christian Outlook, the weekly radio program that sorts through the issues in our fast-changing world in a way that honors your Christian faith. Brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Don Crow. Great to be with you. This week, conservative college students find ideology can be a hindrance.
The professors, because they politically agree with the liberal students and disagree with the conservative students, are giving the conservative kids lower grades than they really had earned.
A warning to the next generation heading off to college.
There's an outright promotion of anything that's antithetical to what the Bible says.
A challenge for conviction and compassion at church.
How to greet the two guys who come in the church door holding hands with each other.
And socialism finds a home in the hearts of many Americans.
They don't really understand what socialism is because they're just too lazy to figure this out for themselves.
Thanks for joining us. I'm your host, Don Crow, coming to you from my home station of WAVA in Washington, D.C. You can learn more and catch my program at WAVA.com. It's the end of the school year. Grades are coming in, some better than others. But there is a growing trend that has been part of the landscape for quite some time. Grade deflation for conservative students. It occurs at an alarming rate on college campuses. Often, students will play the role of a liberal in their papers to avoid grade deflation. Those who present a paper true to their convictions regularly find their papers downgraded as a result. Progressives demand conformity. It's one of their identifying traits. Joy Pullman, executive editor of The Federalist and mother of five, discussed grade deflation while on The Kevin McCullough Show on AM 570 The Mission in New York City.
So why did you write about this?
Well, it came across, my area of interest is education policy, so I subscribe to a number of lists that includes the research done by the University of Arkansas's Department of Education Reform. It's one of the few really good kind of clearinghouses and producers of original research on education that I frequently find interesting. So I came across it when they sent out a notice about some of their latest work. I saw the study, I clicked on it, I read it, and I decided to write about it.
Well, what is this new working paper from the University of Arkansas finding?
What it found, and I have to be clear, it's a small finding, but they said it was statistically significant. So that means it's more likely than not random chance. There is really evidence of something actually going on, that they found in the paper. So they found that self-identified conservative students, they enter college with higher SAT scores and grade point averages than do liberal students. But by the fourth year of college, their GPA dominance has reversed itself. Liberal students graduate college, or at least in their fourth year, with higher GPAs than conservative students. And the three folks who did this paper did a series of statistical analysis to try to separate out everything else. And they did get to the conclusion that at least some of that difference, based on the data they found, is related to professors' bias in the classroom.
So I want my listeners to understand clearly what you just laid out. So you have these conservative kids. Many of them may even be homeschooled, maybe come from private schools, etc. But they're going into college. They've done well on their SATs, higher than average. They've got the GPAs mm-hmm. that are beating their liberal counterparts. But by the fourth year, suddenly they're the dumb ones in the class.
Their GPA.
They're slipping.
A couple of points.
They're slipping the longer uh-huh. that they're in the school. They're getting dumber
right.
as they go, whereas the liberal kids are getting smarter. Joy,
I wouldn't say dumber and smarter. What the folks in the paper were saying is that the professors, because they politically agree with the liberal students and disagree with the conservative students, are giving the conservative kids lower grades than they really had earned.
See, I didn't think it was possible that that would take place, so that's why I was assuming the conservative kids were becoming dumber and the liberal kids were getting smarter. Bias, actual bias, professors
yes.
picking and choosing winners is what you're saying in the classroom.
Exactly, exactly. And so, and if there's further evidence, I mean, and the authors go through a number of hypotheses and they test them to see, to try to, you know, try to see whether their findings are really true. And if it were so, you know, how would we know that's the case? And so one of the reasons that they found that they think this is, you know, the case is because if students were studying in the humanities and the social sciences, which are even more liberal than all the other domains of college,
sure,
that was where they had the biggest, and it's also the least objective, right? You know, there's a lot more subjective grading going into
that's where all
you know,
your
English paper,
feminist studies,
into
and
a science lab. Exactly, exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
So the biggest kind of dip in their grades happened when they were studying in those fields. There was no bias found when students were pursuing professional fields, you know, some medicine, legal studies, that sort of thing. And in fact, conservative students performed better than liberal students on their GPA when they were studying hard science objective fields. So that was another reason that the researchers, you know, thought that the bias was the most likely explanation for what's going on.
If the student can prove that 2 + 2 = 4, they get an A.
Right.
If they're not convinced that Uncle Tom is really Aunt Sally just because he feels like it, they
exactly
may not get the A.
Exactly, exactly.
So what are the findings of the paper? What is the research recommending, if anything? And what have you thought about as a mom who studies and writes about education? What how should our response be to this?
Well, the folks writing the paper basically called for more research. This is the first paper to investigate this question. And so social science, like the kind they're doing, is these sorts of analyses, you know, there's a lot of things that might go into something like this. So, you know, we should want to look for more evidence, you know, before we sit here and know that this is true for sure. So that's basically what they say at the end of their paper. We need to do a lot more work to see if more people find things like this using other data and, you know, other ways of trying to test whether this is the case.
Meanwhile, graduations are taking place all over the country. In many cases, high school students are finalizing their plans to attend college. Years ago, David Wheaton wrote the book, University of Destruction, detailing how liberal professors seek to change the hearts of believers. That effort has since increased. Wheaton explained the latest on Lee Michaels Live on 980 The Mission in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Now's the time to be prepping your kids for getting off to college and not starting to think about this in August.
No, definitely. As a matter of fact, I recommend start preparing your kids when they're about age 5 and
yeah,
6, actually. sometimes, you know, trying to do it all in the summer before college is a little bit of catch up. But, you know, it's never too late to start to realize what's ahead for them and how difficult this transition is to college. I actually think it's one of the most difficult transitions we make in our entire life. You know, we have transitional times, maybe getting married, having children, moving, taking a new job. Those are all difficult transitions. But I know even from my own life,
yeah,
going to college and going from that point of where you grow up and you're basically a state of dependence upon your parents living at home to a state of more independence as you go to college, from having your parental values at home and then forming your own personal values in college. And there's just a lot of things at work there. This is a very big transition. And the statistic in University of Destruction, there's many surveys out there that do this, not just the one I have in my book, but the one I have in my book was a survey done. It was done a while ago. I don't know if it's been done since the book was written, but I think maybe the statistics would be as bad, if not worse now. Mm-hmm. But it says as many as 50% of professing Christian students will no longer profess to be born again Christians after they've been to college for 4 years. So that is a really troubling statistic. If you think about it, one of the most troubling things for you as a parent, me as a parent, or any parent listening, if you're a believer, you take your faith seriously, to think I've raised my son or daughter in my home to love and follow God, to know Christ, and then to have them just basically say, I don't want any part of that after going to college. That's pretty distressing for, I think, any parent.
Yeah, most definitely. And it is a big jump. I mean, I remember back, you know, me going to college, and we're pretty much, you know, peers. We grew mm-hmm. up in the same era, about the same age. And the trials and things. And again, I wasn't a Christian at the time. And, you know, I still think some of the things that I went through, I should have ended up on much worse roads than I did without always having that moral compass or Christ to guide me. And so I think there's definitely been prayer covering me through a lot
yeah.
of that. But the things we never had to deal with social media. we didn't have to deal with the sheer amount of media. I mean, David, you and I growing up, even at that time at college, I mean, there was cable TV, but it wasn't the way it is now. We didn't have access to everything on our phone or through a computer or at the touch of a button. So the influence and the things that are inundating our kids these days has definitely forced them to grow up faster. I mean, I have to imagine, I mean, for most of us, an R-rated movie under 17, it was very hard to see. Now kids can watch anything, anytime. It's an entirely different scenario.
It is, and that's really one of the first two reasons people will say, well, why is this transition so difficult? And you just really described the first reason, because it's a traumatic transition. There's so many things available to this newfound independence that is really difficult for an 18-year-old to handle. You talked about social media. There's really the dorm room and there's the classroom. You know, in the dorm room, you're going to get the same things that you experienced when you were in college, only there's even a greater leniency to it now, whether through sexual immorality or through drugs and alcohol, those things that kids face in the dorm room, the party life on campus. It's actually been just exponentially increased because it's not just heterosexual immorality now that's sort of looked the other way on. There's an outright promotion of anything that's antithetical to what the Bible says, homosexuality, transgenderism. There's actually a great intolerance if you just follow, you know, biblical morality. I think according to the Chicago Sun-Times, only about 14%, this is back in the day too, this is not even now, 14% of students will leave college with their virginity intact. There's an all-out assault on biblical standards for morality. Drug use is encouraged. Experiment with those. Alcohol, of course, is very prevalent on college campus. So you can imagine how just that aspect of it. And then you mentioned, you add to that what you were just saying about the social media, the internet has such great power for good, the propagation of the gospel and all the sermons we hear and everything we hear on the internet. But there's the whole other side to it, too, all the things that are sinful and tempting to young people. And then you step foot in the classroom, Lee, and you get the worldview battle in the classroom where you have professors who are, and I'll use a Christian term here, evangelizing your son or daughter to a non-biblical worldview, whether it's humanism, a cultural Marxism, you know, globalism, it's Darwinianism, you know, whatever it is, they're out to persuade your son and daughter to their own worldview, just as Christians try to persuade other people to the truth of God's word. But they're doing that very actively on the college campus.
We're not just talking about secular college campuses. I mean, I was just reading a story the other day. We were talking about it on Taylor University that were alumni and students were protesting Mike Pence from speaking.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that point up because it's easy to look at the secular college campuses and say, oh, bad, bad, let's not go there and so forth. But the Christian colleges today, many of them, there is a drift. It's sort of like the Ivy League colleges back in the day, you know, 150 years ago. Those were all quote unquote Christian colleges. Look what they are today. They are the bastions, the forefront of everything that is anti-Christian today, everything that's secular and humanistic today. Well, the Christian colleges we see today are going down the same road.
Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership program offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up,
they don't really understand what socialism is.
A shocking poll when the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Don Crow. Pastor Tom Gilson recently sat down with pastoral leaders representing hundreds of churches to discuss the difficult challenges they face trying to love a world that increasingly despises them. These are clearly challenging times for the church, and the church must face them head on. Gilson joined me on The Don Crow Show on WAVA in Washington, D.C. What were some of the issues, some of the leading issues they told you face to face? No, we're not ready.
One of the leading issues was the sex and gender revolution, the ideologies that are coming at us. One pastor said that his group of people, of churches, were getting caught up on the legal requirements That is, churches really ought to have something in their charters explaining who they will and won't marry. And having that in the charters gives them legal protection against requests for gay marriage.
But so some of
having
these...
that legal protection doesn't tell you how to greet the two guys who come in the church door holding hands with each other.
It's one thing to be on record that you won't, for example, perform a same-sex marriage. But as you say, what do we do beyond that when they walk in? What kind of counsel? Well, first of all, what was their response to that discussion? How are any of them handling it? And what do you suggest to even listeners, pastors and church members listening right now when this sort of thing occurs?
Sure. What should you do when, you know, for example, when a couple of men walk in holding hands? I would love for churches to train their greeters and their ushers in this. They should assume that the men are there in order to meet with God. And yet they should also have in the back of their mind the possibility that they're for there for another reason, which would be to stir up some kind of trouble or division. So they should be prepared somehow to deal with it either way. But start with the assumption that they're looking for God, just like every other person who walks in the church, because people walk in the church with all kinds of backgrounds. So greet them happily. Glad you're here. Hope you enjoy the service. Hope we can get to know you. Hope we can be friends. That kind of response will invite them in the door. We need to welcome people into the church. We welcome them on Jesus' terms, which says you're not fully a member of his body unless you do it according to the way that he's determined, not the way that we determine. So we have to bear that in mind. But the first thing is we need to be ready to welcome them.
I couldn't agree with you more. And in fact, if we want to look for the model, the Lord himself hung out with some pretty unsavory characters whose lifestyles he did not approve of ever, but he looked beyond that. And so many of them came to faith and were some of the most outstanding characters of the New Testament after they had been accepted by him without him accepting their sin, if you will. And none of us comes acceptable to God, no matter what we may try to bring, so to speak, in and of ourselves. We're all here standing under grace if we are accepted at all.
That's right. And in one of the passages in the New Testament, it's in 1 Corinthians 6, if I remember right, where the Apostle Paul speaks against homosexuality. It's part of a long list of errors that people
yes.
have made. And he says clearly, and such were some of you, the Christian recipients of his letter. Such were some of us,
right.
many of us.
Right. To hear the rest of my conversation with Tom Gilson, go to ChristianOutlook.com. Any student of history would be shocked by the growing acceptance of socialism in politics today. The very system that brought so much destruction, starvation, and death to the world is finding a home in many of the top Democratic candidates for president. More troubling, a recent Gallup poll revealed better than 4 in 10 Americans now view socialism favorably. Bill Bunkley on Faith Talk in Tampa Bay turned to Tom DiLorenzo, author of the book, The Problem with Socialism.
As we look at what's happening here in America, I was reminded of particularly how the younger generations, you get a generation or two away from, say, a World War II or something devastating, and they don't know the history, and we tend to have them repeat things all over. Now they're embracing socialism. How are we getting here in 2019?
Well, what's happened is, the total takeover of higher education by the radical left, sort of the children and grandchildren of the 60s radicals who now run the universities and have for many, many years. I was at a conference in 1990 with Milton Friedman and some other free market, famous, pretty well-known free market people. And they were saying back then, we have lost the universities, meaning conservatives, free market types like myself, and that was 1990, and has only gotten worse and more radical since then. And now there are hundreds of people in the academic world like myself, but there are hundreds of thousands of leftists and socialists everywhere else. And so who will teach the kids? Who will teach the young people the truth about economics and socialism? There aren't that many of us. It's been a big takeover. And so that's one problem. Another problem is that, you know, that most people, I think, in this Gallup poll are thinking of the welfare state in general. They don't really understand what socialism is. If you were to ask them different questions, like when you want your car fixed, who do you go to, an automotive technician or a government bureaucrat? Or if you wanted to build a house, who do you go to, a professional home builder or the public works department of the city? Or do you prefer competition or a government-run monopoly that can never go out of business and can force you to pay for it, whatever it's given you, through taxes? If you ask questions like that, I think you get very different numbers on a survey like this.
Well, let's talk about the numbers a little more specifically, and that is, according to the new Gallup poll, 43% of the respondents are for socialism, and barely a minority, 51%, against it. In addition to that, half the country desires a free market, and the other half desires a government-controlled one. And I know that there's been much talk about free health care, free education, free this, free that, but nobody's talking about who's going to pay for it. And we all know that socialism works until it runs out of other people's money.
Yeah, that's the thing. You know, there was a poll some years ago about, do you want to do something about global warming? And of course, it was, you know, 99% or something like that, yes. And then they asked, if it costs you $50 a month, would you want to do something? And the number went down to like 20%. And so if you just attach a little cost element to this, like you said, I think these opinion polls would be very different.
Now, when we look at the country of Venezuela, why can't more of the Americans who are sort of loosely embracing socialism, how come they don't understand that we're looking in today's era what happens when you take it to its extreme end?
Well, there are a lot of millions of Americans who do understand about this, but most of them, many millions more, I think, are what the economists call rationally ignorant. They just aren't, they're too lazy or unwilling to spend a small amount of time to understand issues like this. And it's not hard to do. You know, Venezuela, they've destroyed their society with socialism, thanks to Hugo Chavez. And the Wall Street Journal says that his daughter, who's only in her 30s, is worth $4 billion with a B, even though she never started a business or never even had a job, as far as I know. And so it's totally corrupt. It's a theft of wealth by the government. It impoverishes the masses, and there's no secret about that. But you know, apparently most Americans are just too lazy to figure this out for themselves. And the media, of course, are of no help. They bury this. Even I watched an interview a year or so ago with Bernie Sanders, and they asked him if he would care to comment on the situation in Venezuela, and he said no. He didn't want to talk about it. And so that's sort of the cue that the rest of the media, the majority anyway, takes from people like Bernie Sanders. Let's not talk about that.
Coming up, we take on the bullies.
It is no longer a school issue. It is a cultural issue.
The Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to The Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. I'm Don Crow. For as long as there have been people, there have been bullies. But our current youth struggle with bullies in ways that earlier generations really didn't have to. The cyber world allows thugs to harass people day and night, home and away, and even anonymously. I invited Candace Duggar on The Don Crow Show. She's been helping the abused through the Bullied, Broken, and Redeemed Foundation. It is, sadly, a growing subject. I mean, I was bullied as a little kid in first or second grade, very briefly, and my older cousin, who was a junior high cousin, took care of it for me.
Yeah.
She washed the kid's face in snow on the way home. He left me alone. But that's a whole different world today. Talk about today's world and the bullying that's going on.
You know, Don, I try to explain it to parents like this. When I woke up growing up, we watched Scooby-Doo on the weekends. Kids today, as young as 3, 4, 5 years old, we're giving them phones and they have information to X-rated material, and it is not G-rated or PG-13 anymore. And our kids are learning younger and younger, really, if they want to harm someone or hurt someone, how to do that. Social media has become just such a devastating piece in many of our children's. As wonderful it is that we have access, someone can destroy someone's life in an instant. We work with children who literally can have their photos taken in locker rooms and shared all over social media. By the next day, their lives are destroyed, and it chases them home. They don't come home and ever get a break. They literally, bullies will make up fake accounts and come after them in so many different places. It is no longer a school issue. It is a cultural issue.
Well, as you say that, look at the bullying that's going on in the adult world. People's lives are being destroyed right here in Washington, D.C., regardless of which side of the aisle you're on ideologically. Yes. The bullying factor is phenomenal among adults.
It is. It is. It is something that as a society, if we don't start dealing with this in appropriate ways and helping people learn how to stand up for those being persecuted and how to stand up with civic courage, we have a generation of people being lost and hurt and destroyed.
What are some of the things you can tell folks kind of in advance of this conference? Parents listening say, how do I bully-proof my child, let's say?
Well, first, what is the difference between teasing and bullying? And when does bullying come over to harassment and assault? There are different forms, right? So we really want to be able to get them to use the words that are appropriate and the actions. What are their legal? What can they do legally? If their child's in school and they're having problems, what do they need to do in documentation to be able to write it down, to be able to do the legal aspects of it? And on top of that, how can they train their children to be able to advocate for themselves, to be able to stand up to it, to know when and who they can go to? The numbers show somewhere between 1 in 3 to 1 in 4 children suffer with severe bullying, and 70% never tell. And children now as young as 7, 8, and 9 are committing suicide due to bullying. And we want to equip parents to, number one, you guys are on the front line of defense. Our parents, you are the ones who can make a difference. Our schools can't fix this. And so if we can come alongside our parents and show them the warning signs, show them what might be going on with their child, and then equip them how to have that conversation in a heart-to-heart. And then also, what are they going to do with the school? What are they going to do with the notice of intent? How are they going to address it if they've dealt with an issue from sexting? That's another problem in our culture, to cyberbullying. Mm-hmm. Where, how are they going to handle these things legally? And then dealing with the heart of their child. And those are things we're going to help equip them.
How did you get involved in this?
Don, it's actually a tough story for our family. 3 years ago, I had a son that was really struggling. And he was middle school, and I did not know what was going on, but I knew I had a kid who went from happy and great to really angry and broken and hurting and failing in school. And we prayed about it, and God said, if you don't do something drastic, you're going to lose this kid. And we pulled him out of school and started homeschooling him. And it wasn't until about 7 or 8 months later that he really had the courage to start sharing his heart and the pain that he went through. And then a year ago, my youngest son was really struggling. Also, he was coming home with marks on his body and terrible stories and crying under his bed that I would rather die than go to school another day as a 9-year-old. And it was at that time that I thought, you know what? I've been everywhere. I went searching for information. And as a Christian family, I really couldn't find an anti-bullying group to come alongside me with our values and what we were looking to do. And how am I going to help my children? And I said, you know what, God, show us what to do. And so we started our ministry and have come alongside with some local authors who are writing their stories of their abuse, and started putting together workshops. We even do half-day workshops and camps for kids to help them deal with the trauma. And our whole mission is to come alongside our churches. I mean, our churches can do so much amazing work. We just have to equip them with the right tools to come along our parents.
Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They're preparing grounded leaders who impact public policy and serve in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up, a look at the progressive attacks on faith.
We find ourselves in this funny position of evaluating Christians according to Christian ethics without realizing it.
The Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to The Christian Outlook. I'm Don Crow. It is always a challenge to confront unbelief. Some questions are universal. Some are unique to our times. But it is important to be ready in season and out. Rebecca McLaughlin deals with a number of key questions in her latest book, Confronting Christianity, 12 Hard Questions for the World's Largest Religion. She talked about a few while on the ride home with John and Kathy on Word FM in Pittsburgh.
Rebecca, you start your book talking about your arrival on your college campus. You said everybody came sporting something, and you had your big old cross on.
Yeah, so when I was going to college, I was deciding between studying English and studying engineering. And I went to visit my brother, who was at the same college a few months before when I was applying. And I hung out with some people studying English literature, and I hung out with some engineers. And I just decided the English literature people were having more fun.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought I'd do English. But the problem was then that the English literature folks, particularly in my year, I think, we may have sort of spiked on the coolness front.
Mm-hmm.
There were 10 of us in our little college in Cambridge, and me and one other girl kind of stuck out because we were not hyper cool, ridiculously beautiful people who spent their time modeling for major clothing stores or starring in films. You know, that just wasn't,
yes,
wasn't where I was at. And what was worse, as you mentioned, I showed up with this massive wooden cross around my neck because I thought better to get it over it to start with, right? Better to declare that I'm a Christian at the beginning of any relationship, any friendship, and then go from there, then try to introduce that later. So I was kind of a double whammy of uncool and having to relate to some super cool folks there. But in some ways, I think there can be virtue to starting with the more serious conversations in a way and just saying, like, rather than building relationship to the point where we feel like maybe we can gingerly introduce the fact that we're a Christian, almost to find a way to just introduce it from the first and see where that goes.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, so Rebecca, in confronting Christianity, you ask 12 really difficult questions that if you're a believer or you're someone who's interested in religion at all, you end up sooner or later at these questions. And you start off with this age-old question about the world and the state of religion in the world, which essentially is, wouldn't we all be better off if there just was not religion? I mean, it kind of harkens back to John Lennon's Imagine.
Right. I think there is a twin assumption at the moment, at least among many of our secular friends. I live up in the northeast of America, so plenty of secular friends, that religion is dying out and increasingly becoming irrelevant, and that's, broadly speaking, a good thing. We can function perfectly well without religion. Maybe religious traditions met some historic needs, but they can now be met in more healthy, sort of secular ways, let's say. What's really interesting is if you look at both of those assumptions, so one, the idea that religion's dying out, turns out that's a really bad take. And that's a bad take based on the fact that we only really pay attention to white men and not the rest of the world. So the white Western men give us that paradigm because that's where religion is typically declining. But globally, religion in general is thriving, Christianity in particular is thriving, and it's actually non-religious folks that are declining. So that's sort of bad take number one. And then bad take number two is that religion is somehow, in general, bad for us. Now, the two problems with this are, number one, we can't really talk about religion as a monolithic thing any more than we can talk about philosophy as a monolithic thing. And nobody says,
sure.
Right.
Philosophy, it leads us in bad directions. You're like, well, which philosophy are you talking about? Or even an analogy I sometimes like to use is if you said, the drugs are bad for you, if what you meant by that is don't take cocaine, then sure, that's true. But if what you mean by that is don't take the medication that you've been given for your heart condition, that's going to have a very different impact on your health. So we need to distinguish between different kinds of religious instruction and practice. But what's fascinating, if you look at the research that's coming out of psychology, sort of academic field of psychology at the moment, you'll find that actually there are many ways in which religious practice seems to be actually very good for us psychologically. Mm-hmm. So people who regularly attend church at least once a week have lower rates of depression, less likelihood of suicide, more positivity, etc. So there are ways in which it impacts us psychologically. There are ways in which it impacts us health-wise. People who regularly go to church actually live longer than those who don't, and they have lower rates of multiple diseases. We all know that smoking, if you smoke and then quit smoking, that has a positive impact on your health. Turns out if you start going to church, that has an equivalently positive impact on your health. Or like eating more fruits and vegetables. We all think, we all know that that's a good thing for our health. Again, regularly participating in religious community and services has an equivalent impact. And to be clear, not just having general religious feelings or beliefs, but showing up at church or showing up at synagogue, or, you know, it's not necessarily specific to Christianity, but regularly being part of religious community seems to have a real impact on our health. And it also seems to have an impact on how we relate to society. So,
now, Rebecca, before we leave one of your chapters, which is entitled, Aren't We Better Off Without Religion? I want to address something that you address, which is the idea that we just don't in the West even understand how much of what we know, work with, and read comes from a Christian foundation to start with.
Yeah, there are many things which our friends today would think of as just self-evident truths. So, for example, the idea that all men and women are created equal, or at least are equal, whether they think they're created or not, and that we have a moral responsibility toward those who are less well off than us. I mean, somebody sort of starving in the slums in Calcutta has a moral demand on me. It turns out these things are not self-evident truths at all. It's an idea that's come to us effectively from Christianity, if you look back at the history of thought. So sometimes when a friend of mine might think, well, I object to Christianity because I don't feel like Christianity delivers on universal human rights, actually, the only reason that they think that there should be such a thing as universal human rights and equality is because of our Christian history. Mm. So we find ourselves in this funny position of evaluating Christians according to Christian ethics without realizing it.
Right, right. Which taking us into one of your other chapters is the same thing that happens with science, right? We tend to think that the assumption science points to atheism, and that's the end of the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in fact, the modern scientific method was developed by Christians not as an alternative hypothesis to belief in a creator God, but actually because they believed in a creator God who was both rational and free. And so they thought maybe the God of the Bible who had given us moral laws to live by when he was creating the universe, perhaps he created the universe according to sort of physical laws. And that if we go and look and see, you know, examine the universe around us, maybe we'll be able to figure out what those laws are. So sort of ironically, we think of science as an alternative to belief in God. Actually, the first scientists in terms of the modern scientific method developed about 400 years ago were actually motivated by their faith to do science.
Coming up, headlines are calling a woman a pregnant man.
This is the insanity that's happening in our world today.
The Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Don Crow. Elite media outlets decided years ago to call subjects by the gender they claim, not their biological reality, not science, but their opinion or even whims. But recently, the progressives' insistence that you are what you say you are took a dark turn. Bob Burney covered the story on The Word 880 AM in Columbus, Ohio.
This is from the Associated Press. Headline: Blurred Lines, A Pregnant Man's Tragedy Tests Gender Notification. What? A pregnant man? Yeah. Let me read just a little bit of the story. When the man arrived at the hospital with severe abdominal pains, a nurse didn't consider it an emergency, noting that he was obese and had stopped taking blood pressure medicines. In reality, he was pregnant. A transgender man in labor that was about to end in a stillbirth. The tragic case, described in Wednesday's New England Journal of Medicine, points to larger issues about assigning labels or making assumptions in a society increasingly confronting gender variations in sports, entertainment, and government. In medicine, there's a similar danger of missing diseases such as sickle cell, cystic fibrosis that largely affect specific racial groups, the authors write. Now, I want you to notice several things about this. Number one, they equate a man who is actually a woman with race. Now, race you can't change. That is immutable. You can't change race. And scientifically, you can't change gender either. A man is a man, a woman is a woman. The chromosomes don't change. The DNA doesn't change. Now, you can hack and chop and add and subtract physically, but you can change the plumbing, but a man is still a man, a woman is still a woman. It says, quote, the point is not what's happened to this particular individual, But this is an example of what happens to transgender people interacting with the healthcare system, said the lead author. He was rightly classified as a man. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a scientist. But if he is pregnant, he's not a he. He's don't get pregnant. This is the insanity that's happening in our world today. This is only the beginning, folks, unless we stop this nonsense.
That wraps up this edition of the Christian Outlook. Remember to subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Google Play. And never miss these and other great conversations. Start at ChristianOutlook.com. Thanks for joining us today. Our program has been brought to you in part through our partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. For executive producer Russell Shubin and producers Charlie Richards, David Posian, and Michael Cook, I'm Don Crow. Join us again next time for the Christian Outlook.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.